Good afternoon, and welcome to Coastal Conversations, here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant, in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast. My name is Tegan Paulson, production assistant for this episode of Coastal Conversations. We're on the ferry headed from Bass Harbor to Swan's Island. Today we'll talk with three harvesters who lived on Swan's in the heyday of the urchin fishery, 1987 through the early 2000s. They were part of a multinational group who collected green sea urchins. Urchins are small animals. The largest recorded was 3.5 inches across. They play an important role managing kelp forests that have now grown beyond their historic limits. And their roe, their reproductive organ, is delicious. It's usually a yellow or orange, the consistency of butter, and a delicacy in East Asian communities. But now the fishery is a shadow of its former self. It's carefully controlled to allow urchins a chance at recovery. They were harvested by people who put on tanks and wetsuits and dove into the February ocean. People who lived on an island 6 miles east of Ordinary.
My name is Jason Matthews, and I've lived on Swan's Island for 30 years. And I first came here in the winter of 93 for the sole purpose of diving for sea urchins. And I never intended on staying very long. And here we are, 30 years later, home. It was a lifestyle, you know. It was not necessarily a good one or a great one or a bad one. It was pretty good money with a lot of independence. And unlike lobster fishing, we weren't leaving any plastic behind in the ocean. It was not an asset-based fishery. You got in the water and you went and you got it yourself. And probably within 3 days, no one would ever have been able to tell that you had been there. Most all of us that had worked into the late years of the heyday of the fishery, we felt we had achieved a balance with the stocks and our rate and methods of harvest where it was sustainable.
Yeah, my name is, Howard A. Dendermont Jr., and I'm 57 years old now, and my current occupation is commercial fishing lobsterman. Let's see, I first found Swans in 1995, and now we're in 2023, so would it be 28 years later, I think? It's hard to believe, half my life now, I've been out here on Swans Island, and I never would have thunk it. When I first started out, it cost money to get into the business. And, I was doing the wetsuit, but then once you go, you know, you dive in a dry suit, you don't ever want to go back to the wet. So that was neat technology. Good to know. There was we had these Viking rubber dry suits, and those zip up behind your shoulders, so you have to have someone else zip you up. And a lot of these guys I noticed liked the DUI. Suits with you get into the suit and then you zip up from the front, so it's self-donning, I guess you'd say. So I could see the advantage of that. I always stuck with the Vikings because that's what I was comfortable with.
So the tender that evolved over time too, but in the beginning it was pretty standard. But we had a large boat, and then we had a smaller boat with an outboard on it, and the tender would run back and forth between the dive site and divers and the big boat, delivering the bags of urchins from the divers, which you would haul up by hand, back to the big boat, dropping them off to the culler on the big boat, which would then take the bag and dump it out on a rack, remove the debris, seaweed and shells and rocks and things, and also cull out anything that was too small to keep, which would be anything under 2 inches. And then you had the captain maybe, and he would just sit up towards the front of the boat and wait to be paid. I always thought the tender probably had the hardest job of anybody involved.
The tender's always like, we're watching where the bubbles were, and you wouldn't want anybody to quote unquote buzz your bubbles. So as a tender, you were taught like to, when you have the outboard motor and the skiff, never to go over directly over someone's bubbles, because that's where they're most likely to come up.
I'm Jerry Smith. I never dove, but I had the boat and took three divers every day. A lot of us, of course, went because places that we'd gotten urchins in our traps. That's why we went. And so, you know, the last end of it, we had to do more searching, and that was up to the divers. And I pretty much let my divers tell me where we went. I mean, they, you know, they're the ones that's going to go down. They know what to look for. So, you know, we might send one diver down, and if it didn't look good, he'd come back up and we'd go someplace else. Or if he didn't come right back up, we knew it was good, and the other divers would jump in, and you know, it was hit and miss, especially the last end of it.
It was all scuba. Could be anywhere from 3 feet of water to 70-some feet of water. We would dive deep in the spring months sometimes when those urchins were plumping up, the gonads filling out. But mostly it was shallow, one atmosphere, you know, less than 30 feet. You always had to pee, and you always were in a dry suit. So that was probably the most formidable part of the job for me. Maybe other people have more bladder control than I did, but it was cold hands and cold feet. I think maybe as time went on, the gear got a little bit better. Maybe we got a little bit smarter, or maybe we just became numb to it. I always enjoyed diving. I think most of us that did it, probably 97% of the urchin divers, that's probably why we did it, because we liked diving. Maybe the other 3% just had some bills they really had to pay. It was great. At times it was beautiful, the underwater world, when the visibility was great and the sun was shining through and all the colors were popping and the marine life was coming around, visiting, being social, you know. And at other times it was really rough and dark and really beat you up. And as I already said, cold. And you really had to dig deep to get in and do another dive, and yet still another dive, and then another dive. And then to start the day off at dawn the next day, doing it all over again. And you knew you were really into it when you were chipping the ice off the boat in the morning so you could go and get in your day's diving. It was some of the best times of my life, and some of the hardest times. And it was freedom. You know, it was freedom. It was freedom in the moment, and it was freedom of lifestyle every other moment outside of the water.
It was some of them called it a gold rush, some people call it a gold rush, and I'd never heard the term living like rock stars before, but some guy in Portland mentioned that, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, you're kind of right. You had, you know, not, I mean, there was a lot of money coming in, thousands of dollars coming in, but I don't think anyone totally got rich from it. The way they set up the pay was you bring us your whole catch in, and then they grab samples of urchins, usually off the top of your totes, and then put them in a little basket, and they'd weigh all the urchins whole in their shells. And then they'd take all those urchins and crack them open and pull the roe out and put that in a little tray and then weigh that. And then you'd have a ratio, a percentage of how much roe per full urchin there was. And the higher percentage you got, the higher you got paid. So we could get anywhere from, it seemed like 50 to 60 cents a pound to $1.70. I think maybe towards Christmas, the price used to peak into the $2 range. So there was big money to be earned, and the overhead was low. You just had to have your tanks and your suit and your bags and, you know, just your dive gear and stuff.
No, I had some real good, I had two divers most of the time, Sean Clements and Todd Pashardy. Great divers. They were known for getting a lot of urchins. And one Saturday they wanted to leave the island. And I says, let's do a half a day, boys. Get what we can get a little something out of it, and you go on the afternoon boat. I said, all right, they agreed. And we left Trafton's Wharf at 7 o'clock in the morning, got over to Han Island at 7:30, and we got up in a shoal spot to see a lot of urchins, and they dove in from right there, and it was so shallow they didn't have to decompress. So they'd come up, lean over the side of the boat, and I'd change the tanks, and they'd go right back down. And at 11 o'clock, we started back for Swan's Island Harbor, and when we come in sold, we had 4,500 pounds in 4 hours. We loaded the boat. I made a lot of money with those two. When they showed up here, I was at the ferry terminal in Bar Harbor, and this old Ford pickup truck was in front of me with a wooden body on it and a great big trunk that you'd have in your house on the back of it. And here come these two long-haired, terrible, with a great, huge dog. And they walked up to me and they go, we understand you have rentals on the island. And that's when I had the store, had two apartments over it. And I says, yes, we do. And they said, well, we're looking for a rental. And I says, I don't think my wife's going to rent you with that dog and you guys. They got off the ferry boat before I did and got over to the store. And when I pulled in the parking lot, they come out and they go, we got the key. So then I says to them, well, if you're going to live in my apartment, I'm going to start urchining and you'll go with me. And they says, sure. So that's how we all started. And they used to joke about paying me to take them to work, paying me a place to live, and then buying their groceries in my store. They said, this must have been just about like in the old days when the coal miners, you know, they always heard about that. And, boy, they were good guys, good divers. Made a lot of money. They worked together as a team all the time. They, you know, they didn't just jump in. They'd pick spots where each one of them was going to go and come up after the first tank and compare notes. And they were good, really good. Lobster fishermen was tickled to death to see them. Not only did they get a job, a lot of them did, but they cleaned the urchins up off the bottom, and that was the big thing. All of a sudden, the next year, there'd be places after 2-3 years. They were tickled to death they came. I don't know if there was ever any problems with urchin divers on here, and we had a lot of them. And as far as I know, I don't remember of anything in a way, at least no one threatened us, so.
And boats would mix and match, you know, it's like, oh, if someone's not going out this day, but they really want to go, they can get on someone else's boat that is, And we were all kind of a neat community. Sometimes there'd be dinners we'd have with a bunch of us would get together for food. And of course, drinks would be involved. You know, a lot of us were in our 20s and 30s.
You're listening to WERU Community Radio at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. This is Coastal Conversations.
I'm sure there were lifestyle conflicts at times, being Swan's Island a fairly conservative community. I think for the most part, people were very respectful of Swan's Island and its inhabitants, or at least tried to be. And if feathers were ruffled, I think amends were made fairly rapidly. Swan's Island, still to today, and back then as well, seems to have a way of culling out, if I can use that word, the less desirable guests. I think the biggest thing was just adjusting to not being able to go shopping. I mean, we had the store, but it was a great store, but still small and limited. You know, just adjusting to having everything at your fingertips. Whether you needed a bolt to repair something, you could go get that particular bolt. Instead, you adapted to using threaded rod so you could cut it to length and make your own bolt. the grocery store. You know, that was always a treat to go to town and go to the big grocery store. Or just to go to town and have a day away from the island and some anonymity and see some new faces and go in and out of some shops or whatever we would do. Yeah, that was it. But Swan's Island was cool. We were out here and we had a lot of great diving right at our fingertips, and that's what we were all about. And the people were fantastically welcoming, even though I'm sure we looked like circus people to them. You know, the carnival had come to town.
Tony, the Bulgarian, had skipped out of Bulgaria while it was still under Russian control. There were three of them, him and his brother and another guy, and the other guy got killed. They shot him going over the fence, and they made it. And before that, they were gymnasts for the Bulgarian government. You know, they were going to the Olympics and stuff, and then they come over here. His brother couldn't speak any English at all. He could. And they had a inflatable, probably 10 feet long, with an outboard on it. And they'd go out, and his brother would go overboard and fill up his bags, and he'd bring them up and change his tank, and the one that couldn't speak any English would bring them in quick to Thames Wharf and get rid of them and get fresh tank and then go back out the times his brother was up. And he'd come in, and when he went to go back out, the outboard wouldn't start. And we knew his brother was out there, but we didn't know where, and he couldn't speak English. So he got aboard the boat when we went out, and he kept pointing, go this way. We found him after a while. It was a crazy time. It was fun.
There was a Vietnamese guy who I'd seen in Booth Bay when we were harvesting in Booth Bay. His name was Tam, and I guess he had really good cuisine that he would share with people at night on the wharfs. And he was interesting. He was unique. He was very tough, and he dove alone, which is really, I mean, people were dying in this industry. It was became popular, and before, I don't know if it was before licensing, but on the cusp of that, people were just putting any old suit and tank on and going out after the urchins. And I think we lost a few, maybe up to seven people over some years, and that was sad to see.
Yeah, Davis boy. And he come down from Patton, Maine. Never been on a fishing boat, know nothing about it. So I told the guy that was getting through, you got to go today and show Dave the ropes. So we always had, I guess, we used to have cleanup parties. Never drank while we were working, but when it was all done, the end of the day. So we come into the dock and we started cleaning up. Oh, Mike Borgard, they'd all come aboard, you know. Dave goes, we're all out of, we always drank Meyer's rum. And he says, we're all out of rum. I says, I'll go up to the house and get another bottle. You guys clean the boat. And he was one of these guys wanted to be gung-ho. The minute I stepped on the float, he goes, got the boat all clean, Jerry. I says, good, you wash the boat, kid? He goes, I would if I knew what in the hell it was. He was a character.
And what's driving the whole thing is money. And sometimes you can get greedy and make really bad decisions. So yeah, I was the biggest hazard to myself for sure. You know, you watch out, it gets really cold, the second stage regulator, the piece that goes in your mouth, you know, could ice up and free flow. You know, it's not that dangerous. You just react accordingly to it. Of course, most of the time, we're not diving so deep. If something else was to go terribly wrong, you couldn't do an emergency ascent to the surface safely. Well, they did make everybody take a safety course, which I thought was probably well-deserved. Although, surprisingly enough, there was so few fatalities and injuries. I'm still amazed at that.
We were over in Isle of Hull on the outside of the island there, right on the east side of it. And I heard someone on the boat radio go, "Mayday, Mayday, we're sinking." So they taught us we had to take a course to be an engine tender, outer diver, that if you hung an empty tank overboard and hit it with a hammer, the divers could hear that underwater ringing. So I did, and up come the divers, and I said, "We got a boat sinking over here, it's your boat." So went up around to go in between Isle of Hull and the island, and I'd never been in there before, I didn't know how to go, and it was all ledges, and Junior Bray from Stonington, he taught me through it without being there. "Now look out, there's going to be a ledge on your right, another one on your left." And we got there, and they were up on the bow of the boat, and she was just barely. They'd hit a rock, hit it so hard that pushed the keel of the boat up into the base of the engine, and the base went up and froze up the crankshaft. And we just picked them off the bow of the boat. And down she went. Well, when we got there, after they got off the boat, I tied to the stern of my boat, and the guy goes, that owned it, he said, "Oh, she won't sink, she's full of balsam." Yep. Blub, 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 down she went. Nothing sticking out with the antenna. I took and I towed it into the beach on Isle of Hull, and some guy was watching this, and he a couple of weeks later, he wrote an article for Stonington paper, and he says, "I've seen the weird fishing." He says, "Guy put a line overboard." He says, "The next thing I know, he hauled a boat come up."
Commercial urchining picked up steam in 1987. Landings peaked at 39 million pounds during the winter of 1993. That same season, 6 divers were killed, prompting action from the state. A moratorium was passed on new licenses in 1995, and by 2001, nearly half of Maine's 829 urchin divers had let their licenses expire.
All the divers around here dropped out of it. I don't think there's a diver around here ghost anymore that I know of. They may be, but no one I knew. The state was all right. I mean, it was all new to them, too. You got to remember, all of a sudden, bang, we got a $1 million industry going that we don't know anything about. So, you know, I'm certain they were trying their best. Just a lot of it I didn't agree with, but then that's my privilege.
I think it might have been 2000 or 2001. But I remember the day, and it was opening day of the season, and there was already much fewer divers involved in the industry by this time, early 2000s. So the smaller harbors like Swan's Island, we no longer had a buyer here. So everybody, the divers had migrated to the larger harbors that had good access to the urchin bottom. So I was fishing out of Stonington off of that dock. But we were landing over there and I was staying in a town adjacent. First day, we'd all gone out diving, and what we saw was lots and lots of dead urchins. And we all put in a harvest for the day, and we all came back to the dock, and everybody was just wide-eyed with saucers, you know, talking to one another on the dock from different boats who had gone to different spots for the day. And we're like, "Wow, did you see that? Did you see what I saw?" Yeah, so that marked the end right there. I think we all put in the rest of that season working amongst lots of pockets and deep holes where the dead urchins had accumulated and just turned white like bones. Was no longer that beautiful work environment we had enjoyed for so long. Pristine, it had a dark, unpleasantness to it.
I've had more arguments with science teachers. She's not my stepdaughter. I raised a girl, and when she started high school, she had a choice between going to Sumner or Ellsworth. So we get down to Ellsworth, and we had to go for first day at Sumner one night so she could look around and everything. It was in the science room, and the teacher was there, and he had an urchin shell, and I picked it up, and he goes, "You know what that is?" And I said, "I've handled many of them." "Oh, you were an urchin." And he's the other one of the ones that killed off all the urchins. I go, "You have one clue what you're talking about." I said, "When's the last time you were an urchin?" And we left there, and my stepdaughter, she goes, "I ain't going back there." So she went to Ellsworth. He ruined that. But that's how it was. I mean, the state still to this day believes that we overfished them. And I always say, when we first started, we could take anything. And then they put on a minimum law. What happened to all the small ones? Why didn't they grow up to be bigger ones again? They all died. There was a boom to the island. We noticed it in the store. You know, all of a sudden, people weren't asking to charge groceries. They were paying for them, you know. It was a lot of money for one of the time. Especially when your traps are all on the bank and there's nothing to make until you set them out again in the spring.
Howard and I went out from here. Let's go, just the two of us together. So we were captains and tenders and colors and divers.
We went out to Gooseberry Island one day just to see what was going on with the urchins.
And we went out and we did one dive piece. And we were doing all right. We were getting it together to have a paycheck.
And we started out pretty good with a nice harvest of pretty urchins. And then we went to other places that used to be hot spots, and it was like a moonscape.
We just looked at each other and shook our heads, and for what few healthy urchins we were coming across on the bottom, we just didn't feel right taking them anymore.
And you could maybe see like some dead urchins and shells and stuff, but it was really sad to see. I mean, a lot of the kelp was gone too, so that virus, I just want to make a point that, you know, as far as sustainability goes, that the virus did a lot more damage than the urchin divers, because divers, we'd work an area, and someone else could go back to where you were a week later, and the urchins would like regroup and go after the feed, and they'd come up from down deep. But that was sad to see. So that was like the last time I dove.
And that was the last day I ever went urchin diving.
Howard Dentremont now lives in Bass Harbor. He still lobsters in the Swan's Island zone. Jerry Smith moved off island some time back. He now lives in Ellsworth. Of them, Jason Matthews still lives on Swan's. He's also a lobster fisherman. They're three of the few remaining urchiners who fished from Swan's Island 20 years ago that remain in the area. Most of the rest have since moved on. Galen Koch, Olivia Jolly, and Natalie Springle assisted in the production of this episode of Coastal Conversations. Thank you for tuning in. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you're hearing in the background is called A Following Sea and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. The show was narrated and produced by myself, Tegan Paulson, production assistant for this episode of Coastal Conversations. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.